for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama announces a major overhaul of U.S. policy toward Cuba. Sony cancels release of the movie The Interview after threats of violence. And Jeb Bush makes moves toward a 2016 presidential run. Here for the week's top stories on the Friday News Roundup, Ron Elving of NPR, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and Reed Wilson of The Washington Post. And since it's Friday, you can watch a live video stream of this hour. Go to our website, drshow.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Well, I'm glad to have you all here.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to be with you, Diane. To see you all. Ron Elving, tell us what's in this Cuba change of policy.
The most important thing about the change is the attitudinal change, the atmospheric change, the change of face. We are turning our face to Cuba in an entirely new way for the first time in half a century. And that alone is going to change many things, not only about the commerce, not only about the tourism, not only about the money, but about life in the Western Hemisphere. And we're starting to see more and more reaction from around the Western Hemisphere, from Latin America, about how transformative this really is. Now, on a more practical level, very few Americans have been able to travel to Cuba in recent years. That's because of the restrictions, and only under very rigorous conditions have Americans been able to go. That's going to change. It's going to get a lot easier to fly down there for a visit, for a vacation. People are going to be able to use their credit cards there. U.S. banks are going to be able to operate there, and we're going to start to have some kind of trade. Now, there is a trade embargo in place. Congress has to lift that. The president can't do it on his own. But the momentum towards that happening is going to begin, it's going to swell, and it's probably going to be irresistible.
So, Reed Wilson, how much can the president accomplish without the Congress?
Well, he can ease some of the sanctions, but as Ron says, because of a law that President Clinton signed back in 1996, he's not going to be able to open to get rid of the trade embargo entirely. What this will do is, as Ron says, it not only changes our entire outlook towards Cuba, it also brings us into line with the rest of Latin America. And having read some of the – or having looked at some of the front pages of the newspapers from all around Latin America, there was unanimous celebration of this decision, whether it was from Mexico City or from Honduras and into Venezuela. And one of the papers in Miami, one of the Spanish language newspapers in Miami, had carried a headline the next day that said, "Obama breaks down the wall," which I thought said most of it.
And what about this prisoner swap, Molly?
Well, Alan Gross has been the big headline out of this. He was the State Department contractor that Cuba believed was an American spy. He was installing telecommunications equipment that could have been used to help Cubans access the internet freely. And he was imprisoned in 2009. And a lot of senators have been working on his release, particularly from Maryland, his home state. And so when he was released, we saw Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen and a couple of others go down there to come with him back. The U.S. released several Cuban spies who had been prisoners here in the United States who had also similarly been a sort of cause celeb in Cuba for their imprisonment. And there was another American prisoner in Cuba also connected to espionage who was also released. And So that was the deal that sort of allowed these floodgates to open.
That last one was rather important, wasn't it, Ron?
Clearly a key to the deal. Now, we don't have a name here.
We do have a name. The name came out. His name is Rolando Saraf Trujillo.
Ah, okay. And I'm glad that you had that.
There you go.
We had been working for a couple of days with no idea who this person was, except that he had been in prison for 20 years and that he had been involved in identifying some of the people who were spying for Cuba in Miami, and that he had been kept under very rigorous kinds of circumstances, probably even worse than Alan Gross, and that this was somebody that the United States very much wanted to get back and would not give up the three remaining Cuban spies until they had him.
So we've got several Republican presidential hopefuls who are very unhappy about what the president has done, such as Florida Senator Marco Rubio, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. How is this going to affect their prospects for election, Molly?
The politics of this are very interesting, particularly for those of us who have studied the ever-crucial swing state of Florida, where the Cuban vote, the Cuban exile community, makes up a large part of that ever-important Hispanic voting bloc, but a shrinking percentage. And in particular, the Cuban exile community from that first generation that actually fled communism and fled Castro themselves, that is a shrinking proportion, even of the Cuban population. Many more of the Florida Cubans now are of a younger generation who are not as opposed to the embargo and who are more in favor of normalization. In fact, this year, for the first time, some polls started to come out that showed that not only was there overall popular support for lifting the embargo, but even in the Cuban community, a narrow majority favored lifting the embargo.
Now, so, does that sound as though it's the younger generation?
Yes, it is clearly, yeah. If you look at the crosstabs of these polls, it's the younger generation that's changed that calculus. But it is still a huge political third rail, particularly in Florida, particularly for the Cuban community. And it's interesting that the presidential hopefuls that you named all have connections to that community. Rubio and Cruz both are Cuban. And Bush, of course, is the former governor of Florida who has deep connections to that community.
You know, it was interesting to me to hear Marco Rubio this morning say, I don't care if the polls say 99% of the American people are in favor of this. I'm not.
And the overwhelming argument against lifting this embargo is the notion that we didn't get anything from this. We didn't. The U.S. didn't benefit at all from
Is that true?
I think it's debatable, and I think the larger point is that we now have the ability to impact change more in Cuba as a major economic trading partner. I mean, this is somebody likened this to the relationship between China and Taiwan. China has influence over Taiwan because they are so close, and because China, as the world's second largest economy, clearly dwarfs the Taiwanese economy. So too will the U.S. economy play such a major role in Cuba that we may be able to force some change that we wouldn't by continuing an embargo that we were the only ones participating in. Everybody else was trading with Cuba. So the argument that that we didn't necessarily get anything, that the Castro brothers are still in charge, that the political situation there hasn't changed much, is what the opponents, and it's not just Republicans. Bob Menendez, the outgoing chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a Democrat from New Jersey, is very much opposed to this as well. But that was their argument. The alternative is we now have leverage.
I would just add one thing to that, and that I think that the core of what Rubio is saying in that quote that you mentioned is that this is not a practical argument about what we receive in exchange. It's a moral argument. It's saying that we must never appease communism. We must never give an inch to this oppressive regime, and that anything short of of regime change would be not getting enough in exchange. And so I think it was very interesting to hear how the president presented this as moving on from the divisions of the Cold War as a sort of overdue signal of a new world order where those old divisions, you know, with the Soviet Union are no longer applicable, and it's time to sort of march into a bright new future. And that's and this is the sort of larger critique of Obama's foreign policy being naive, being weak and appeasing that Rubio has been making for some time now.
That's right. This is a principle for Marco Rubio, and it is a passion. President referred to people who have passionate responses to this, and certainly he is entitled to those. His parents were anti-Castro Cubans. This is something so to the heart for people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, whose father also left Cuba. This is something so close to their visceral sense of themselves, they really shouldn't be expected to make an ordinary decision about this
or to have an ordinary view. But how is their position likely to affect their bid for president?
Well, their bid for president is going to be strong in the Cuban community of Florida, but just now in the gubernatorial election down in Florida, Charlie Crist actually held his own and narrowly won, I believe, the Cuban-American vote, according to the exit polls in Florida, even though he has taken a position like what the president has done, and even though the Republican who won re-election, Rick Scott, was against it. So this is no longer the absolute make-or-break issue that it was in Florida. And here's another calculation, because all of this is kind of geopolitical. Jeb Bush, if he's the nominee, you pretty much have to take Florida off the table for the Democrats. If Jeb Bush is the nominee in 2016, he's going to carry his home state. So the Democrats are at the point now where they can stop worrying in presidential elections about where they are on the Cuban issue. They're probably going to be on the side of the angels. And as the people over 65 who oppose this, well, let us say, retire or expire, they're no longer going to be the Cuban vote.
Ron Elving, senior Washington editor for NPR. Short break here. I see there are already lots of callers. We'll move on to other thoughts right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, now with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. More at Lumosity.com. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com. And from Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting Olin College, which is working to revolutionize engineering education, at olin.edu.
And welcome back. If you're just joining us, you can watch live video streaming of this hour, the Friday News Roundup. Go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. Here's an email from Susan. Kind of interesting. Could our next president reverse Obama's decision regarding U.S. policy toward Cuba? Long shot.
I think that highly unlikely. And I would say that even though the next president might very well be Jeb Bush, and we know where Jeb Bush stands on this issue. But reversing things of this nature is extremely difficult to do.
And here's another one from Thomas in Charlotte, North Carolina. What does rapprochement with Cuba mean for Guantanamo? Could it speed closure of the detention camp there, or do the two things have relevance?
They don't have much in common. The U.S. has a long-term lease on the area of Guantanamo Bay. However, President Obama has been moving very quickly in just the last few weeks to rid Guantanamo of its last prisoners.
True.
He just sent six to Uruguay, I think.
But there is still something
120, 130, something in there. But it is a major priority of his administration, though it's not related to this particular move.
What about Rand poll. I thought his comments, his reaction was interesting, Molly.
Right. We talked about some of the Republican presidential contenders who are strongly opposed to this policy, but Rand Paul actually came out in favor of it, showing that this is a policy that divides both parties to at least some extent. I think it makes sense as being sort of a piece with his libertarian orientation, wanting to see free markets, wanting to see trade, believing, like other Republicans, like Jeff Flake of Arizona, that the best defense against communism is capitalism, that exposing the Cubans to the American capitalist economy and the fruits of that is the best way to sort of break down their political order.
He had a three-word explanation for why he thought the policy ought to change. It hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. What has succeeded in other parts of the world is opening up. If you go to any store as we approach Christmas, you go to any store and you look at the garments and you will see that most of them say either China or Vietnam or someplace like that. And many of those countries, of course, at one time were just as verboten to Americans as Cuba. To say that because it's so close to our southern border, because it's 90 miles from Florida, that we simply can't ever forgive or we can't forget. Well, it's not forgive. Nobody is really asking anybody to forgive. It's a question of moving on. And that's what some of these Republicans are saying.
All right. And let's move on to the 113th Congress is finally on the home. What did they accomplish, Reid?
Well, you'll hear a lot of people say that this is the least productive Congress in modern history.
And most unpopular.
Most unpopular is correct. However, it is not the least unpopular, or the least productive. In the last few days, they managed to pass enough measures to give them 297 new laws passed, compared with 284 laws passed by the 112th, the last Congress.
In how many days?
Yeah, I know. It's a low bar to clear. Yeah,
really?
But
yeah.
But I mean, the Senate confirmed 134 judges this Congress, 293 executive branch nominees. Those are high. That was obviously a product of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid rushing to get all of President Obama's nominees that he could confirmed before Republicans take back control.
Including of the Surgeon General.
Including the Surgeon General, who was very controversial. Including the Deputy Secretary of State, who was controversial, a new head of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and some other folks, people who have been waiting for confirmations as long as 500 days, which is, you know,
ridiculous.
A year and a half.
Ridiculous.
A very, very long time.
I want to just go back to the Surgeon General for a moment, Ron Elving, because it would seem that this man, this physician, took a position regarding guns as a health issue. Would any doctor, any other doctor, have disagreed with that position?
Well, certainly the results of a shooting are a health issue. But Vivek Murthy had the temerity. He was courageous enough, choose whatever word you want to use, to associate this with gun control policy and to talk about what people can do in terms of possession of guns, in terms of their use of guns, shy, of course, of committing crimes with them, is highly controversial in this country. We have established that there is a voting majority in many, many states that will rebel against any politician who talks about restricting their Second Amendment rights. That is one of the powerful political realities of our time. And while other issues that might be called social issues or, you know, if you will, crime issues have moved in one direction, the gun control issue has not.
And what about his First Amendment rights to talk about what he believes in?
Well, I don't think anybody is saying he can't talk about it. What they're saying is they don't want somebody who feels that way as their Surgeon General. And here is a brilliant young physician, widely acknowledged to be so, who is in some respects the Democratic Bobby Jindal, if you will. And rather than going into electoral politics, as Bobby Jindal did with all of his mastery of health care policy and so on before he became governor, he has chosen to go this particular route and serve in an appointive capacity. And that nomination would have been extremely difficult to get without two things. One, they had to get to the 51-vote threshold instead of the 60-vote threshold to invoke cloture. And Harry Reid, of course, did that as the nuclear option, the sort of unilateral move by the Senate Majority Leader to make it possible to approve the president's nominees. That made it possible. And then, of course, the lengthening of the session right at the end made it possible for Harry Reid to get 24 appointments, including this one, confirmed.
Molly.
Well, you know, just to broaden this a little bit, a lot of us have been looking at this lame duck session for what it portends for the new Congress. Looking at the way Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell approached each other and did or didn't get things done in the month of December after the election, where Republicans did so well, you know, first there was this idea that there would be a little bit of a thawing because Republicans wanted to show they could govern. And then Obama did his executive action on immigration and the Republicans clutched their chests and fell over saying, well, now we can't help him with anything because he's betrayed us. And the truth ended up being somewhere in between that they actually did. It was very interesting. In the final days, there were uprisings by the bases of both parties. You had, first, it looked like Democrats were going to shut down the government when Elizabeth Warren and Nancy Pelosi and a lot of liberal Democrats didn't like some unsavory elements of the fiscal deal that was put together by both houses. Then when that failed, it looked like Ted Cruz was going to do it again when he mounted a last-minute campaign to force the Senate to stay over the weekend and take some extra votes on immigration.
And he got backlash for that.
He got some backlash for that. But the important thing is both of those gambits failed, and Reid and McConnell crafted an agreement that allowed this tremendous number of nominations to go through and almost all the last-minute legislation to be passed and the government to be funded. So there will not be a shutdown, at least until February. That qualifies as a good result in Washington these days. We've bought ourselves a few months.
Wow.
So I think that tentatively may bode well for the new Congress that's coming in January.
Homeland Security is funded only through
February. The rest of the government is funded through September.
And that's in retaliation for the immigration executive
that
order.
That will allow Republicans, when they control both the House and the Senate, to craft a response to President Obama's executive actions on immigration. It's not clear what that response will be. Some hardliners want it to be very aggressive. Many of the business wing of the Republican Party, if you will, wants this to be the impetus for a Republican-generated larger immigration reform bill. If that debate becomes the centerpiece of the 114th Congress, then we're going to see a real stark division within the Republican Party. On the presidential level, you're talking about a division between Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush, one hardliner on immigration and one more sort of call him the Chamber of Commerce Republican. In Congress, I think it remains to be seen which side of that debate holds the upper hand within the Republican conferences of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate.
How do you think that's going to go, Ron Elman?
I think in the long run, the Republican Party is going to come around to a more realistic attitude towards the people who are already here and refocus on border security. Border security is always where we regress to the mean. Both parties are all for border security. And, of course, we are always promised it in every new immigration bill. We saw it in 1986. And then, of course, the enforcement either doesn't happen or doesn't work or is superseded by either new methods of people getting around it or by just the sheer overwhelming numbers. Now, right now, immigration is off for the last several years because of the softness in the U.S. economy. But as the U.S. economy improves, and it has been improving rather dramatically, and when that is fully into the system, you're going to see that magnified once again.
When you say it's improving rather dramatically, what do you mean?
I'm saying that in the last jobs report, there were 321,000 new jobs created in the previous month, and we're also revising some of the earlier, softer months to be more jobs produced. We're seeing the unemployment rate down below 6% again, and it looks like it's going to stay there and continue to decline towards 5.5, which would be, in some people's minds at least, approaching full employment. So that's a huge thing because not only is the stock market doing better, and that's a whole separate discussion,
right?
But now we're starting to see that actually reach the broad base of the economy. We're seeing not only more jobs created, but somewhat higher wages.
Oh, and why is the stock market doing such flip-flops?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, as Ron says, there are macro signs that the economy is doing better. The trade deficit has come down a little bit. The middle-income wages are rising for the first time since the recession.
A tiny bit,
but it is the first increase that we've seen. seen.
Yeah.
You know, the real problem was we've essentially had wage stagnation for a decade. Any movement at the moment is good news. And then you've got and a lot of the gyrations. You know, we had the Dow gained 400 and something points
yesterday,
but before that, you know, it sank by multiple days of triple digit losses, in large part because of the price of oil, the declining price of oil, that declining price of oil has created a global economic sort of shift, if you will. Russia's economy is doing very poorly, not just because of Western sanctions, but also because it is essentially a state-run oil business with a couple of subsidiaries.
And we'll talk about that in the next hour.
But here in the U.S., by the way, there are a number of states that rely so much on oil revenue and what are called severance taxes, that's the taxes on the stuff they pull out of the ground, that the declining price of oil is really threatening their economy. States like Alaska, Louisiana, New Mexico, and North Dakota all face some really difficult challenges. They were making so much money when oil was selling for $100 a barrel. Now that it's near half that, there's a trigger in North Dakota that if oil goes below a certain point, I think it's $52 a barrel, then they have to cut their extraction taxes in half.
And isn't it interesting that in this week of all this talk about oil, Governor Cuomo in New York said there will be no fracking.
You know, this was a project that he supported largely because it was a way to get some economic development into the more remote parts of the state, where they mountainous areas of the state. People think of New York, they think of Manhattan, but there are vast stretches of New York that are very rural and even mountainous. And in those areas, it's been very difficult to get economic development, and this was a chance to do it.
The Marcellus Shale.
Exactly, and this was a great boon. Now, on the other hand, these are the people who would be most directly affected by some of the environmental impact of fracking, which could affect water, could affect groundwater, could affect drinking water. And there has been a health analysis done there in the state of New York that's just recently been delivered that said, yeah, there's some real question marks here, something to be worried about. So Andrew Cuomo saw this as his opportunity to make that difficult split-the-baby decision.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've talked about what Congress did accomplish. What did they leave undone, Molly?
Well, the major thing that was left undone was the terrorism insurance bill. This is something that an entire industry relies upon for authorization. And there was even some talk that without it, the Super Bowl might not be able to go on. It looks like the Super Bowl will not be canceled, for better or worse. Depending on who you're rooting for, I suppose. But this does throw a real wrench into the insurance industry. There's talk of whole projects being canceled because of this. And it's a classic sort of exhibit A of Washington dysfunction, where both parties wanted it, both houses of Congress wanted it, but a single senator was able to put the kibosh on it.
That
was Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who's on his way out and who's known as sort of as Dr. No for his insistence on these types of things.
And why?
Well, he's from Oklahoma, and he's a populist, and he has many times used a kind of curmudgeonly attitude to express the unhappiness of his constituency with what they see as crony capitalism, what they see as the federal government doing things for big guys and not for little guys. And in this case, he sees it as the federal government backstopping the insurance industry, which is what it is, not unlike the Price-Anderson Act that indemnifies nuclear power plants beyond a certain loss because the insurance industry couldn't underwrite the catastrophic losses from a nuclear power plant accident. So we've had this going back more than half a century. And this is something a little bit like that, saying that if we had a major terrorism attack like we had in 2001, the insurance would be just so wiped out by any really big attack that no insurer really wants to do that
business. So is that going to be on the agenda when Congress comes back?
I would say immediately.
That and the Keystone Pipeline?
The Keystone Pipeline, speaking about oil, the Keystone Pipeline is a fascinating sort of case study of this rapidly changing economy. Mitch McConnell, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, has said it will be his issue number one. It will be the first bill he introduced uses. However, the oil that comes out of the Canadian tar sands that would actually flow through the Keystone Pipeline is some of the most expensive to produce in
and
the world.
And dirty.
Yeah, but because it is so expensive and because the price of oil is dropping so dramatically, some people are wondering now, including the companies themselves, whether or not it makes economic sense to actually produce them when oil is only at $54 a barrel. If oil is back at $100 a barrel, sure, it makes economic sense because you're spending, I don't know how much it costs, call it $50 a barrel to extract. When the profit margin is so much smaller, it's not clear that makes economic sense. So,
what are the prognosticators saying about how long it's going to take oil to get back up to $100 per barrel?
It could be a significant amount of time.
Right.
The states that I was talking about earlier that are planning for this, such a dramatic reduction in their severance taxes, which is such massive parts of their revenue, are planning for several years of low oil prices. In the long run, yes, oil will climb as demand climbs in developing nations around the world. But at the moment, the U.S. is producing so much. OPEC has declined to cut its own production. There is no increase in prices in the near future.
Reet Wilson, he's staff writer for The Washington Post. He writes the Post political tip sheet email called Read In. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from World Vision, a Christian organization dedicated to serving the most vulnerable children, working in nearly 100 countries to provide fullness of life by tackling the root causes of poverty and injustice. Learn more at worldvision.org. From the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy PJs, footed pajamas for warmth and personal style, in solids, holiday prints, and a new cuddle puff down. More at pajamagram.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, world reaction to new U.S. policy toward Cuba, Pakistan buries victims of a school massacre by the Taliban, and U.S. officials grapple with how to respond to the hacking of Sony Pictures. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. If you've just joined us, you can also watch this hour live. We're streaming on video. Do go to drshow.org. You can watch our brilliant guests at work this morning. Sony, North Korea. We don't know if it's North Korea. We don't know what's happening. Apparently, the hackers are in the process of getting ready to make a statement. What do we know so far, Ron Elving?
We know that the release of this movie has been canceled, that it will not have this worldwide Christmas Day release.
The Interview.
The movie is called The Interview. It's a Josh Rogan movie. And it is, by some accounts, not necessarily the world's greatest movie, but it has certainly become the world's most famous movie. And who knows if we'll ever see it. I feel as though we've seen about half of it just on cable television over the course of the week with the sound turned down, with the all these scenes being shown so that we get the idea of how satirical this movie was and how insulting the North Koreans might have found it. So whether or not North Korea has done this directly or whether they've acted through surrogates and whether or not they've had an inside person, and there's some reason to suspect that there was somebody with a lot of knowledge of how things worked
at Sony. Or somebody inside Sony who simply didn't like Sony.
Well, had some issues with some of the people who worked there, and those emails that got released that destroyed the reputations of those people. Certainly, that's where the whole thing began. At that point, it was more of a kind of giggling sort of story, and people laughing behind their hand and saying, "Wow, look what happened to those poor guys! Boy, I hope nobody ever gets into my email." But now it's really become a much more serious international issue and a much more grave situation because we are treating it as a national security breach affecting the United States.
And what does that mean? That if they've got the ability to do something as big and broad as that, there is no stopping them?
Well, let's assume that at least some elements of the United States Security Administration and the military and many other American businesses, industries, and public service utilities and so on have a little better security than Sony turned out to have. Let's assume that for the moment. But who wants to have all of those people under attack? Who wants to have those kinds of attacks happening to everything that depends on computers in the United States?
One thing that Congress did before they left this week was they passed a measure that would allow the Obama administration to come up with what are so far voluntary guidelines for cybersecurity for major industries, whether it's the power industry or the infrastructure industry, whatever that happens to be.
But apparently, the hackers have written to Sony, "We'll secure your data unless you make additional trouble."
Yeah, and this is a really troubling precedent, not only for Sony, but also for the White House. The White House has concluded, apparently, with 99% certainty, according to our reporting this morning, that North Korea is behind this this particular attack. But they don't really know how to respond. And this is something approaching an act of war. How do we respond? There are no more sanctions that we can put on North Korea. We've already placed all the sanctions on them that we can possibly do. Military action? I mean, these are some of the debates that are going to happen within national security circles, but it certainly presents a big, big challenge to the White House moving forward.
And we're just seeing now that there are officials saying that they do believe that this was an external breach, not an inside job. That strikes a lot of people as implausible, given the primitive nature of sort of North Korean infrastructure and the fact that its own citizens don't have access to the internet. But actually, North Korea has a history of very sophisticated cyber attacks, thought to be perhaps in collaboration with the Chinese, but they have a training program for young computer scientists who are given a lot of privileges in North Korean society and who, again, have repeatedly done this in the past, who have committed these sophisticated acts of cyber terrorism. So that is why, even though there hasn't been an official designation of responsibility, a lot of U.S. officials have already said this attack does bear the signature of the attacks that North Korea has done in the past. So there is a lot of, this is something that the intelligence community also has been warning about for a long time, that cyber defenses are very porous, that those of American and other international companies are very porous, and that we're just not very well defended against this sort of thing.
Let's take a caller. Richard in Rockville, Maryland has a come and go right ahead.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Happy Friday.
Hi.
I'm wondering if the events at Sony Pictures will lead to a softening of the Justice Department's position against universal email encryption. And the reason I'm asking is, following Edward Snowden's famous revelations, he also said that from this point on, email users must use robust but easy-to-use encryption for any emails that they don't want to be available for the world and governments to see. But when Apple announced plans to begin providing this automatic email encryption as a default option for their users, FBI Director James Comey in the Justice Department said, quote, "Apple is marketing to criminals, and stronger encryption would lead to horrific tragedies such as pedophilia and children dying." Do you see the Justice Department ever adjusting its stance on universal email encryption, given the obvious need for companies and individuals to be able to communicate confidentially.
Well, this is the irony, right, is that the Justice Department doesn't want people outside of the U.S. to or countries outside of the U.S. to be able to hack into our systems, but they wouldn't mind a backdoor to be able to conduct criminal investigations on their own. So, no, I don't think they will change their broader stance. However, I do think you're going to see new calls and debates and some legislative action on Capitol Hill, or at least talk of legislative action, that would mandate some kind of stricter security guidelines, at least for the systems that we all depend on, whether it's the the infrastructure like traffic lights and sewer systems or power facilities and things like that. They are voluntary now, or they will be once the Obama administration comes up with the standards. But who knows? We could be talking about some stricter regulations.
I wonder whether person-to-person communication is going to have a new explosion, face-to-face communication, simply because it's always been my belief you shouldn't put anything into an email you don't want to see on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times or here on NPR. Let's go now to George in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment about the Sony hack there. You know, we have free speech in this country, but no society has consequence-free speech. And, if these guys had been making a movie about the assassination of Barack Obama, you can bet there would have been some intensive examination by that situation by the Secret Service. So, but even more than that, Kim Jong-un is a kind of a quasi-religious figure. At least he's viewed so by North Korea. And so, when you desecrate, something religious, you can expect a pretty strong reaction. And, Hollywood studios have decided that discretion is the better part of valor when it comes to making movies about the Prophet Muhammad, for example. They don't do it because of the obvious reaction that's going to generate. They realize, that not everything that can be said necessarily should be said. It's maybe not worth the hassle to say it. And, my final comment is just I'm thinking that the interview is probably just going to be a direct-to-video thing, and maybe that's best for everybody's safety. And I'll take my comments.
All right. Thanks for calling. Do you think it's going to go direct-to-video, Molly?
It seems almost inevitable that at some point this leaks out in some form. As Ron was saying before, so many of the clips of it have already been seen. Obviously, the North Koreans have seen it, and that's what they objected to so much with some of the content in it. So, but part of the reason that Sony ended up backing down was that already a lot of major theater chains were refusing to show the picture because of some of the threats that had been made by North Korea. And so, the lawyers at Sony saying that this is a liability for them as well, and they couldn't take that chance. So we had already seen, that theaters didn't want to show it. It is funny to think, absent this kind of publicity, whether the movie would have done well at all,
exactly,
considering that critics were not exactly hailing it.
Well, we did get an impression from what we have seen over the past week in terms of these excerpts from the movie that it's a lighthearted romp, and it is a lighthearted romp in a sense.
Except,
however, it ends, and the caller makes an excellent point, it ends with the leader of North Korea, who is a quasi, he can many, many different things, but he is, as the caller described him, a quasi-religious figure, and certainly important figure to the North Koreans, and his head explodes at the end of the film. That is not one of the excerpts that we've been shown over the week. So the truly serious way that this could be taken by someone in another culture that would obviously take it as an insult to their culture, that scene has not been shown.
All right, let's go to Margaret in Los Angeles, California. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. My remarks echo George and your last speaker. I think of, although I'm horrified by what has happened to Sony, North Korea is an isolated, paranoid, very rigid country. They feel attacked by many, many countries in the world. And I think there's a question about the judgment of a company that makes a comedy assassination movie about the sitting leader of another country. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would just mention that a few years ago, North Korea applauded a movie that depicted George W. Bush being assassinated. So there was a bit of a double standard. One other thing I think it's important to say is that the Department of Homeland Security has said there is no credible threat to movie theaters or you know, they threatened to, these hackers threatened to attack movie theaters. DHS says there is no credible threat.
All right, to Richard in Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. What I would like to say is that Reagan gave amnesty to about 4 million Hispanics back in when he was president. Now we're going to look at another 5 million. And we've got a total of about 15 million to 20 million already that aren't documented and that are currently in the U.S. Each one of those provides a sanctuary or a base of operations for their relatives. And if you figure 4 or 5 relatives per person, in 20 years, you're looking at over about approximately 80 to 100 million Latinos. How do you regulate that? What's going to be the state or the demographic shift in our population in 20 years?
Rather dramatic is what I'd say.
Well, we already have a Hispanic population in this country. Right. That's roughly equivalent to the African-American population in this country and becoming and will soon be the largest minority group in the country. In California, there are an equal number of Hispanics and Anglo-whites. That is already the situation, and the Hispanic population is growing faster. We are seeing much the same kind of change in other southern tier states like Texas and Florida. I think some of those numbers are perhaps exaggerated that we just heard. 12 million is the figure I've most often seen for undocumented people in the country right now. Some people think it's less because of the economic conditions we talked about earlier.
That and not all of them are declining. Hispanic.
And certainly when you're talking about immigrants and you're talking about people who are undocumented, you're not talking exclusively about Hispanics, primarily, but not exclusively by any means.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Emily in Colorado asks, what does Jeb Bush's likely run mean for other potential Republican candidates at this point? Reed.
This is a fascinating question. There were a number of candidates who have been thinking for a very long time about delaying their entry into the race. In 2012, we saw a number of candidates who got in very early, run out of money. Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, had to drop out, you know, 4 or 5 months before the first voter actually got to cast a ballot. This time they were planning to delay, planning to make announcements in April or May or even June. Now, however, because Bush has gotten in so early, that has shaken up a lot of timelines. And that's because Jeb Bush appeals to a very specific and influential set of Republicans, and those are the Republicans with money, the Republicans who are able to write big checks and finance these campaigns. Because he occupies that sort of business wing of the Republican Party, what we see is a couple of other candidates who might be interested, who might try to compete for those same donor dollars, people like Chris Christie, mm-hmm. people like Mitt Romney, starting to change their calculations. One of the stories that we've heard over the last couple of days is that the reason that Bush got in so early is because Mitt Romney was really actually thinking about making a third run for president. And his sort of public overtures were aimed at forcing Jeb Bush into a decision. Wow. He thought if Jeb Bush didn't run, then he would have to run to hold up that sort of end of the business wing of the Republican Party.
Not like.
Yeah, Reid is exactly right. You know, Jeb Bush, as someone who's been out of office now for so long, really has to force his way into this conversation. And so that's the advantage for him of making this early announcement. It's also a dynamic that we're seeing for 2016 that is the opposite of the Republican primary dynamic we had in 2012. In 2012, you had one establishment candidate, Mitt Romney, and then a bunch of other candidates trying to be the conservative alternative. This time around, there's a couple of self-styled Tea Party candidates, principally Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, but a lot of candidates bidding for that establishment mantle. Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, governors like Bobby Jindal and Scott Walker and Mike Pence, all also going for that sort of Chamber of Commerce donor set, potentially. There's some crossover, at least. And so there's going to be a very crowded started jockeying for the Republican establishment this time in a way that we didn't see in 2012. And so that's why you see someone like Jeb Bush wanting to signal to those donors who like to pledge allegiance early and pick a favorite that he wants in.
And there's been some active interest on the part of those donors in not being distributed out across the entire field the way they were in 2012. Molly's quite right. It was almost a matter of you get your billionaire and I'll get my billionaire and we'll go to war. That worked well for individuals who ran further into the primaries. I'm thinking of Newt Gingrich in particular, than they otherwise could have. But it was not good for the party in the end, and it weakened their candidate in the end.
But, you know, it's interesting. We did not hear from Chris Christie on Cuba.
And Christie has been, you know, Christie has a shtick, if you will. He's got a personality. It's a very big personality. He likes to pick fights with people in the crowds at town halls, and everybody cheers him for that. But on substance, he has not – Cuba is not the only thing that he has not commented upon. He has been very cautious, politically speaking, about taking positions before a lot of other people do. I think this is going to be a –
sort of watching to see how the wind blows.
Watching to see where the mines might be. You know, Christie has
– another way of putting
he's,
it.
Well, he's stepped in it a few times, and he doesn't want to do that again.
All right. We'll have to leave it right there. Reed Wilson of the Washington Post, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Ron Elving of NPR. Merry Christmas to all of you.
And to you.
Merry
and
Christmas.
To you, Diane.
And have a good holiday, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.